Session number 6125, reel 9.
Mr. Hale, tape 9.
Mr. Hale, before we go any further, could you perhaps tell me something more about the living conditions and sleeping conditions at the prisoner of war camp in Shanghai?
Yes, when we first arrived in Shanghai, the Shanghai British Red Cross had contacts with us, and they were able to bring in for the British primarily, but it ended up with a general distribution throughout the camp with the Americans and the hospital that they had there, various tins of food, and they were able to get us in some sort of warmer clothing. A whole mass of civilian greatcoats came in, far more than were necessary for just the small contingent of the British personnel in the camp, which I think amounted to about 80. So we were able to push those out amongst the Americans. And we were able to make a selection of some overcoats, and a certain amount of footwear came in, which we were able to use. But unfortunately, the Americans became very, very jealous of the handouts we were getting from the British Red Cross in Shanghai, and they made representations to the Japanese, who were only too pleased, unfortunately from the British point of view, to stop the Red Cross coming in to us. This, of course, had a backlash, in as much as we weren't able to contribute any further to the hospital, where, of course, we were all more or less resident, both British and American, at one time or other. Also, the British Red Cross in Shanghai, they managed to bring in some medical equipment through good offices of the Japanese medical officer, a Captain Tendo, I think his name, Kindo or Tendo, I think his name was. I think he was of German-Japanese extraction. And although a medical officer in the Japanese army then had very little authority, he would take his orders from a sergeant or sergeant major, who apparently was an infantry man. He was able to, with the help of the Shanghai branch of the British Red Cross, get in a certain amount of medical equipment, which even consisted of some sort of an X-ray machine, which was very, very helpful. And some sort of anaesthetic apparatus was brought in. Of course, that was all left behind when we moved from Shanghai. It was bitterly cold in the winter time. We used to get the wide open to the Siberian winds, and I think I mentioned that we took down a Japanese graveyard, a metre and a half. Thankfully, we were allowed to use the wood from the coffins to put into the stoves that were at intervals throughout these long huts, and the Japanese allowed us to burn that. Of course, the smell of this, I think it was a cedar wood with the remains of the bodies that had been in there, the smell was most unpleasant, as one would imagine. But it did at least go in some measure to keep us warm. The weather was so cold that I've seen men open the door and go out and faint with the cold. They'd faint rigid. Similarly, to when I was in India, men used to go out of the cooler bungalows outside, get hit with the heat. They would faint with the heat. Similarly, in Shanghai, they would faint with the cold. They used to take us, one of the big jobs we had, I'm not sure whether I mentioned it earlier on, was to working on the Shanghai race course. They took us down in trucks, and a lot of this was before we got kitted to a certain extent with footwear. A lot of us had to climb onto these trucks in our bare feet, and to experience going in the bitterly cold wind standing on the steel plates of a truck with the wind blowing underneath the truck, men couldn't get down off the truck. They had to be helped. The Japanese guards had to pull them down, and then they couldn't stand. We couldn't stand with the bitterly cold that attacked our feet. It was really perishing up in Shanghai.
Did people try to improvise footwear?
Oh, yes. We With the wood that they got from the coffins, they would try, as we did in Shamshi Po, Hong Kong, to make up wooden clogs of some form. But one of the biggest difficulties was to get a strap, to get some sort of material to form a strap. The sleeping accommodation there, we were on wooden platforms raised about 2.5 to 3 feet, I suppose, from the level of the mud floors, the wooden planks, and then we had a rice mat. And over the top of that, we were allowed one, maybe two blankets of a thin quality, from which the sailors among us, among the British prisoners, those sailors that were that came ashore from HMS Petrel and the Merchant Navy people, they were able to draw certain strands from the blankets and knit. And they knitted up socks and mittens, and that amazing what some of the men could really do. And from the wood, from the coffins, a lot of them used to carve. And the sleeping accommodation, as I say, on boards, but we've aggravated with rats. You could hear them gnaw, gnaw, gnaw all throughout the night hours, and they would also venture out during the day for food. I've seen them walk along the beams in the daytime, and I've actually seen one fall from a beam into a bowl of rice that a CPO was eating at the time. And they used to run over our feet at night. You could feel them run, and you'd kick. And I personally kicked at a rat one day. It was on my foot, and I know from the yell that it landed from where I kicked it onto the face of a sergeant who was sleeping two or three down, spaces down from me. We used to have to provide a nightly picket. The Japanese were frightened of fire. And one from the British section and one, or maybe two from the British section, from the American section, had to parade throughout the night. We used to take it in turns, used to have an hour on at a time, one American and perhaps two Americans, because there were far more of them, and one of the British personnel used to go on a rotor system. We all used to take our turns right throughout the night. We were parading in case of fire. Between the barrack blocks, the Japanese made us dig huge fire breaks, which became pretty well filled with water. And at certain times of the year, the frogs used to occupy these places. And, of course, the noise was just like being in the jungle. These frogs used to start croaking at dusk and go throughout the night. And if they used to stop, we used to wake up because it was so quiet. Further to that, we did have such a large colony of frogs that when the Italians surrendered in Shanghai and the Japanese put them into the camp with us, the Italians got so hungry that it was quite common to see them get these frogs and hardly wait to even char them what they would eat them. They were so hungry. Well, in the fullness of time, the Japanese told us that we were going to move, going to Japan, and they gave orders that biscuits were to be baked by the Americans, so a certain quantity of flour and salt and I don't think there was any fat brought in, but biscuits, or hard-tack biscuits, were the American cooks started to make these, and they worked on these for some days and nights, and sacks were provided, and that was supposed to be our food on the forthcoming journey. And I think it was in about April, February, March, April.
Have you got any idea why you took such a roundabout route around the north of China?
I just think they didn't know what to do with us. I don't think they were ready for us to go to Japan. Another thing was, of course, as time was going on, it was difficult for them to get any ships across because of the torpedoing of originally the Americans, of course, And then the British fleet began to get out there. The British fleet, as I understand it, never had the long-range submarines, but of course there was a big force of British surface vessels coming out. And the Americans were very, very active with both their submarines and, of course, from their bases, aircraft bases in China. And, of course, they got their big flying fortresses, B-17s and B-29s, were the big flying stuff that we've seen going over regularly over Shanghai. And they're far, far out of range of anything that the Japanese had in Shanghai to get at the B-29s. And, of course, anything that floated, they pounced on it.
Did you, because of that American pressure, did you think that the Japanese were bound to lose in the end?
Oh, we never had any doubts from the time that we surrendered in Hong Kong, but what we wouldn't win. The only thing was that worried us whether we should get out of it in time to celebrate the winning, or what were the Japanese going to do with us? And they told us in latter months of the war that if the British and Americans ever landed on Japan, all prisoners of war were shot, either as put up in the front line or else executed out of hand. We had no doubts of that, except those who, thank goodness, adopted the attitude that when there's life, there's hope. And then I myself was, to a certain extent, although I had quite a bit of faith, one had to be a fatalist and say, well, what is to be will be. It's something that I find I can't do now, but I could then, possibly because we were all in it together. But one never really, unless one was through ill health and malnutrition, got in a very, very poor mental state, one had to keep going and have faith that something would be done to get us out. I mean, if you don't have faith or hope, you might as well give up and wrap up. Of course, one of the worst things they found that they were supposed to have had wireless sets in the camp. I know on some occasions they were. And if what the Americans called scuttlebutt and what the British called rumours were released saying that something good was going to happen to us, like the Americans and British were landing or the war peace overtures were in the making and that. And if these things didn't eventually take place, they found that some of the men were taking it to heart so badly that they just folded up and died. So that the release of any good news was very much tempered with the thought that should it not happen, you'd likely to have some deaths on your hands by people just giving up hope.
When you stopped at Tientsin and Peking and lived in Godowns, presumably the thought was that you might stay there for a considerable period of time.
We did. We were still with the Formosan guards who were in charge of us in Shanghai. They came with us all the way and more or less handed us over when we reached Fushan in southern Korea, where we stayed for about 4 to 6 weeks. The passage of time, even at the time, was hazy, and now after the lapse of all these years, actual months and weeks have kind of telescoped in. But I do recall that we were in southern Korea. I think they called it Pusan. They've now changed the name of it, I think. We stayed there for about 6 weeks until eventually they took us to the quayside and landed us onto some boats to take us through what would be the inland sea of Japan. And I think I've got a feeling I've done this before, haven't I, when they took us across. There were a lot of civilians on board these ships.
No, we didn't get round to that last
time. I've done when we went up through Nanking, haven't I? Yes, it wasn't a very long trip, and we noticed that the Americans watched us survivors of Lisbon Maru very closely, because we discarded anything that we were carrying. We kept it close to hand, of course, and we took off our footwear because we felt the chances were highly likely that we were in for another sinking, and we got as near the gangways leading to the upper deck as we could, but we'd been handed over to Japanese guards then, which was a change from having the Formosan guards, and they were very much like the Koreans, far more brutal than the Formosans were. And because they were carrying a lot of civilians, including women and children, they were inclined to huddle us and herd us and segregate us generally from the civilian passengers. And I don't think the journey could have taken much more than about 24 or 36 hours, as I remember it. And we went across to a little watering place, I suppose, in Japan, a little harbour, quite sheltered, quite pretty, I think. And we, in the fullness of time, were allowed off, and they gave us some sort of meal of rice and fish. And they allowed the prisoners, those who wished, to have a swim. And it was really lovely to get in the water, even if you weren't capable of swimming, to have a jolly good wash down after the journeys that we'd had. And then, of course, came the journeys. They were loaded onto trains, and our journeys came up through... we must have been in one of the middle islands of Japan, because we were south of Tokyo in Yokohama, because we were herded onto the trains, and they made us pull the blinds down of the trains. Very crowded we were, standing and sitting, and... we weren't allowed to look out of the windows, though, of course, with the blinds being down, men were looking out of the windows, and we were able to see from then on, right until the end of our journey, the devastation that had been done to Japan. There were just mile after mile of just rubble, where presumably they'd had wooden hutments, and they were just burnt to the ground.
What happened if you did look out?
You were beaten up. And subsequently, your name was taken by the Japanese. We all had numbers, and they were taken. And when you reached our destination, which was in the coal mines, right at the very north of Japan, in Hokkaido, these men were disciplined and flung into... the equivalent of jail within a jail by the Japanese, and subsequently released when the war finished. One man did shape up to the Japanese, and a member of the Royal Scots, actually, a person by the name of Hume, Private Hume, and he got badly beaten up on the train by the Japanese, and that was a salutary lesson to all of us, that if we were going to peer out through through the curtains, we laid ourselves open to a very severe punishment.
How many of you were there on the train?
Well, there was the whole of the Shanghai camp, of course. I suppose there must have been about 60 British, and perhaps 200 to 300 Americans. Those that from Shanghai, they had taken away the Merchant Navy seamen. Both the Merchant Navy officers and the Merchant Navy deckhands, seamen, and they'd taken those away, and they'd taken away certain of the naval personnel. They'd left us in Shanghai on a separate shipment to presumably Japan. But we were in the second and final shipment, the lot I was in.
And it was an ordinary passenger train that you were on?
In Japan, it was. And I think if I remember rightly, you stepped down, you didn't have to step up into the Japanese trains, you just stepped across from the platform. And when you left the platform, although the curtains down, we were able to see at times when there were no Japanese about. As you left the platform, the Japanese would all be on the end of the platform and they would bow. And the look on their faces when they realised they were bowing to us was really something really to behold. But it's something that's always carried through the politeness of the Japanese railway staff to the passengers. They all formated on the end of the platform and they all bowed from the station master down.
And then a sort of horror took over.
And then the opening of the mouth to see two or three carriages of British and American prisoners of war going through was really something, because we didn't hesitate to give hand signals to what they could do with themselves. But we eventually arrived in the Tokyo station, and there was no doubting we were in Tokyo because the name was up, Tokyo, and we were taken from the train down into the archives, or the cellars of the station. And whilst in there, we experienced very, very heavy air raids. We went out into the town of Tokyo, and they put us in go-downs and kept us there. But it was only for a matter of hours. And they gave us some sort of a rice meal there and brought us back in the dark, underground again, under the Tokyo railway station, where we had these air raids. And then they took us, when this particular air raid had finished, they took us from the tunnels underneath up onto the Tokyo railway station platform, indicated the trains we were supposed to get in, and started herding us in, when we got rushed by a big mob of Japanese civilians, men and women, and they set about us with poles, sticks, anything they could lay their hands on, beating us. And fortunately for us, the Japanese, they soldiers there were interested in getting us on. They were driving us on the train as hard as they could with their rifle butts. Well, those who hadn't so far got on the train were getting a terrible beating. And an American turned around and he hit, I think it was a woman, and you really heard her head crack as he hit her. And she went down. Unfortunately, the Japanese guards never saw that. And I'm sure he must have broken her neck, because you could really hear it crack. And eventually they got us on and got us away. And we reached a place called Hakodate, which was the crossing point from the Honshu, I think it was, to Hokkaido. And we stayed there and we had a meal. And my particular pal, who ended up as the best man at my wedding, he said he would get the meal that indicated that we were going to get. On the way up at intervals, they had stopped and provided a meal for us, which consisted of little boxes containing about a cupful of rice. It was warm, and they were in kind of a little bamboo or casket. You've got two of these caskets per individual. One contained the rice, and another one contained some sort of savoury. It might be a bit of dried fish, or it might be a bit of green stuff. Might be something fried. Just enough to keep you going, for which we were very, very grateful. And there were buckets of hot water on the way up, which if you had any utensil, you could help yourself to the equivalent of their green tea, buckets of boiling water with the green tea leaves swimming about in it, which in the end, before we finished in Japan, we found were quite palatable. And since I've been back to the Far East, I've been able to take this green tea and quite enjoy it. However, we reached Hokkaido in the night, and my pal said that he would get our rations, and he got the four boxes, two for himself and one for me, one of them with rice and the other savoury. And starting on the savoury, he remembered very well, he said, "Well, what do you think of it?" I said, "It's all right." I said, "It's some sort of shrimp. Fried shrimp." I said, "I wish I'd taken the legs off them." Hell, we had those, and it was dark, and we fumbled around, we ate them. And in the morning, in daylight, just about the time they reckon they're going to move us, they said the meal was ready again. So I went and got the meal this time. When we opened it, we found that it wasn't shrimps we were eating, but it was grasshoppers. And they didn't go down too badly, anyway. And we crossed the water again from to Hokkaido, I think we did. I don't remember there being a bridge. There may have been. Anyway, they got us to Hokkaido, and after about 5-6 hours, they detrained us and marched us through a village, which they indicated was where the coal mines were. And there were some vacant huts on the outskirts of the village, which they marched us into. I think there were three or maybe four huts, sufficient to contain the whole of the party. We found there were some British prisoners of war already there in two huts. I think it must have been about 150 to 200 British prisoners of war there. In fact, it gave us a balance of a majority of prisoners of British to Americans, whereas it had been an American camp. It now became a British camp. There were some officers there, British officers there as well, which outranked what American officers we had with us. Then, of course, the huts were very similar to the ones we left, wooden platforms. They had the heads, as they called them, we call them toilets, at the end. I think probably two taps, and the toilets all formed part of the huts. You didn't have to go outside the huts for the toilets. They were earthenware affairs, which before the surrender went, the Japanese wouldn't allow them to be emptied, either by themselves or the POW personnel. They filled up and they were flooding all their sleeping places. There was about 2 inches of filth. We trailed from our beds into all this filth, particularly those that were nearest where the heads were. We had no Red Cross. We immediately were put into mining gear, which consisted of a hat made with some form of waterproof material, with a rather reinforced cardboard clip in the front, which we found would contain our hat, our lamp. And we were handed over to the police of a morning, who marched us to the coal mines. And then we did our stint coal mining, 16 hours a day. And there were also night shifts. You kind of double banked for part of the time. So it was 16 hours by day and 16 hours by night from the time you left your bunk. You did your mining stint, and then you came back again to your huts. There was you had to walk down a long shaft to reach your face. The actual face...